When you send me packing down in Green River Valley, I knew that if you couldn't, then no one would have me. Lost myself drinking with those stray dogs.
What's up, y'all? This is Adam with Mile High Stash, the podcast that asks what five albums you would take to a remote Colorado cabin in the event of a zombie apocalypse. Doug Gaddy, who owns and operates Absolute Vinyl Records and Stereo in Boulder County, currently Longmont, along with his wonderful wife Annie, is celebrating the shop's 15th anniversary this year. I've known Doug and Annie since I was the drummer for a then upstart fledgling Colorado band called the Yoppers 13 years ago, and we did an in-store performance at Absolute Vinyl. I guess it was in the fall of 2011. I remember Doug offering to give all three band members whatever record in the store we wanted. That's the kind of guy he is. Anyway, my kid and I recently had a staycation at a hotel in Longmont with an indoor pool because we had nothing else to do over that holiday weekend. And I invited Doug to stop by for an episode of Mile High Stash and talk about Absolute Vinyl. Music was discussed, tears were shed, laughs were had, and I'm happy to share that episode with you today. I'm going to be traveling a lot in March to Washington, D.C. for a conference and then to the Gulf Coast of Florida again to see some spring training Major League Baseball. So I hope you enjoy this episode of Mile High Stash featuring Doug Gaddy of Absolute Vinyl, and then I'll see you right back here on the first Monday in April, as Dr. Dre says, for the next episode. Here's my chat with Doug after a few words from this month's sponsor, the Boulder Roots Music Project. I was at the big annual opening night festivities for the Boulder International Film Festival a few nights ago, and amid all the fancy people in town, most of the folks I ran into who were friends of mine were either working the catering or working sound, except for Roots Music Project owner and founder Dave Kennedy, who was playing the blues guitar at the big party at the Boulderado. Dave is a great guy, and the Roots Music Project is an amazing place.
The Boulder Roots Music Project believes in the power of music to make the world a better place, and all music starts locally. The Roots Music Project empowers artists and audiences to connect and create a thriving and inspiring local music scene. Based in Boulder, Colorado, the Roots Music Project's mission is to foster a DIY music scene with events such as concerts by local and national musicians, open mics, live interviews, and workshops. Head to rootsmusicproject.org for their event calendar and more information about this great Boulder nonprofit music incubator.
So Doug Gaddy, you're originally from South Carolina?
North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Yeah. Big difference.
Yeah?
Well, at least in my era, I don't know about now. Both states seem to be, I don't know, maybe North Carolina is kookier than South Carolina now. I haven't been back in a while, though.
Well, I know that Asheville is supposed to be the Boulder of the Southeast.
That's, and it's nice there. My wife, Annie, has a niece who lives there in Black Mountain, and that's lovely, but it's surrounded by just, it's, if you venture too far out, you encounter the folk.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So you and I are both long talkers.
And we're old friends too.
And old friends with an emphasis on old. And my kid who is here right now, her like least favorite thing when she was growing up, she's 14 now, but she's known you since, I don't know, she was probably two or so.
Yeah.
And she absolutely would hate if I said that we were going to go see Andy at Albums on the Hill or Doug at Absolute Vinyl, and that's because we could never get out of there because we would talk too long.
Do you remember when? I think I had a Charles Bradley test pressing.
Yeah, and we won it.
And you won it, and yeah. And Say came with you.
Yeah.
And I remember smiles on both your faces.
Oh, yeah.
It was a lickety split. I remember it was an in and out visit, too.
It's like a love hate thing because she would always be like grabbing my shirt and just being like, can we leave? So that's why I'm setting a 1 hour timer for us because I know we would talk for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know,
and it would be excruciating for everyone.
So you are celebrating the 15th anniversary of Absolute Vinyl, correct?
You've done some research. Yes, I am. I know.
Yeah.
So someone notices.
Yeah. So how many years have you been in Longmont?
Five.
Yeah.
It was five, like December 5th, I think, is when we opened 5 years ago.
And it's been a big improvement in a lot of ways, right?
Well, it's different. It's everything is different than everything else. But Longmont's really happy I'm there.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be in Longmont. Boulder is totally different than when I left. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way. It's apples and moon rocks. There's no way to compare anything. Given the last 5 years of existence on Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, everything's been touched by the tumult of you know, that period, so.
But I don't know how much you can say, but I think, you know, the rent is a lot cheaper, and you have, there's a sales term for this, but, you know, foot traffic, whereas in Boulder, it was more, you know, people would go in order to go to the record store, and now maybe they're just passing by, and they're like, oh, cool.
That's well observed and is more true than not, but again, it's not hard and fast. I'm still a destination for people.
Yeah.
I've got customers that remember the North Boulder location, how funky that was.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I've got folks that are still coming because they, you know, it's like once you've been bit, you know, they just keep coming back. And it is true that Main Street has a lot of foot traffic, but there was always tourist traffic in Boulder. Mm. And so it was this weird thing of, people come to town and they have things that they like to do in that town. So I would become a sort of destination within the bigger destination experience they were having, folks coming from Texas or California or wherever.
Yeah.
So it's a mix of both.
But you're really happy you made the move.
And I'm really, okay, here's a new sort of wrinkle on the things. Longmont has experienced a lot of inward immigration.
Yeah.
You know,
including me.
Oh, that's true. And so in recent months, I've just observed, I talk with everybody who comes through the door, literally. You know, try and engage them. And a common question is, where are you from? How are you here? And I just moved to Longmont is a really frequent.
Yeah.
So a lot of new blood into the shop, so to speak, in terms of, you know, the customer base. And a lot of old, long-time customers I'm not seeing quite as frequently. Two different phenomenon, but, you know, it's like folks out exploring because they're excited to be in Longmont. They find it to be an interesting place to live.
Yeah.
And other folks, like, I've got plenty of records, or I'm watching my budget, or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm just afraid to go to record stores right now because I know how much I'll spend when I show up. So,
well, I have ways of addressing that situation, but that's another topic.
Yeah. But 15 years of Absolute Vinyl, but you've been selling records like at shows and other things for how many years?
35 or 36. Yeah. I think I did my first record show in like 1986. Yeah.
Yeah. And the story is that, you know, you are, you know, like the music geek, long talker like myself, and your amazing wife, Annie, is kind of the one who knew how to talk to people. How to talk to the nerdy guys like you.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it's true. I went back and reread. Adam, by the way, folks, still writes for Westword, did a lovely profile of the shop, and me and my cohort, Basil, in 2016. Mm-hmm. And I went back and reread that just for grins because we were there. And it's true. We noted then Annie could make guys who are a little bit, men particularly, or record store customers, make them feel at ease.
Yeah, she's great at that.
Yeah, she was good.
And so, Giselle now is also good at that, too.
Well, Giselle's like, she's a phenomenon of life. She's wonderful.
Yeah.
Giselle Coyuzo, folks, a member of the great band, the 89s, which you can catch at Winter Walkabout, which is coming up in Longmont soon. The 89s are a really good band.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm lucky. I've had really good employees across these 15 years.
Well, I remember when all those kids from First Base Tapes were working there too.
Yeah, and I was just hanging out with one.
Which one?
James Calvet.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's a social, he got a master's in social work, I think, and he works in a public school in Denver.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, he is awesome.
A lot Donato of and Liam and Colton, right?
There's a few dozen of them, and I'm in touch with most of them still. That's great. And it's really wonderful. Yeah.
So, Absolute Vinyl has always been known for a few things. One is that you're really good with selling used equipment and then new turntables. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think you're the only store that I know of that cleans and grades every single record. And that is such a weight off. I think me personally, I'm much more inclined to spend, $16 on a record rather than $14 if I know that it's cleaned and it says, this is good, very good, excellent, excellent plus, all this stuff. And I'm somebody who buys used vinyl only, and I really like finding copies of stuff that it might not be the original, but it could be an 80s pressing of something or 70s pressing of a 60s album. And knowing that I'm not just going to look at it in the light and think this is pretty good and then bring it home and realize, oh, this is actually not that great. So where did that come from?
I know the ache of heartbreak is my, because I get this from folks and people come to the shop. I don't want to, sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but there are people who say, I only come to your shop for the very reasons you described. And for folks who aren't really oriented as record shoppers, the condition of the record is really important, at least to me. It's interesting that it's not so in recent years.
How could it not be important? Sound
ageist in reverse, but younger folks, their concern about the condition of things is different than yours and mine, and yours might be a little different than mine.
Yeah, and it's also
it came honestly because years and years ago when eBay came around, I was on eBay within the first year of its existence, and I was selling rare stuff, and my minimum price point was like $50. Mm. So you had to, and that was in the I guess that was in the early aughts or the late 90s when eBay came around. And he's selling to Asians and Europeans, and they're incredibly fussy, and I don't want to hear back from them except to say, your grading was really good. This is a wonderful record. So I just started taking it really seriously.
Yeah.
And, you don't want to go out to shop for a used car and see one, even if it's got a good price on it, if it's hail damaged, it's like, it's a goofy analogy, but it works. It's like, I want people to know what they're getting. And when they get home, I want what they believe they were getting in the shop to hold true once they get home.
Yeah.
And as a result, no one really returns records.
I have returned records to other stores.
Yeah.
Local stores that I will not name. And it's hard to buy vinyl online, not only used vinyl, but new vinyl, because it's, shipping can be eccentric.
Yeah.
And also, these new records that are the 180 gram, sometimes they show up and they're wobbly.
Quality control has gotten better in the last few years.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's an interesting little tidbit. Back in the day when I was selling records, European pressings and Japanese pressings were kind of regarded higher than American pressings. Mm. And one day it just dawned on me, Japan, I don't know, in 1970 or 80, it was probably a country of 100 million people. Mm. The UK was a country of 60 million people. Those are the populations of single states in the United States. But these are entire nations, so their whole industry about manufacturing is geared towards serving a population of that size. Mm. Pull out to America and think of when, Thriller or a Paul McCartney record hits, every pressing plant in America is making those as fast as they can to satisfy our, at the time, 250 million people. And so more mistakes are going to happen.
Yeah.
And so fast forward to today, quality control, you know, 10 years ago was really an issue because we'd kind of forgotten how to make records.
Yeah.
Everybody
yeah.
thought records were done.
Right.
And that's why I just focused on vintage stuff because, duh, you know, CDs.
Well, those of us who are real dorks, really, like, when you grade your own records and put them in the Discogs and all this stuff, you look at them under the light.
Sure.
And you see the names of the record plants where they were made in the 60s and 70s.
The wind-off grooves.
And they used to be everywhere.
Yeah. But so, anyway, fast forward to today. Quality control, they kind of have an idea that the golden age of record pressing lay more in Europe and Japan. Yeah. And guys that really, you know, like VMP, Vinyl Me Please, mm-hmm. They had quality control. I shouldn't say this, but they had some QC problems, but they take it really, really seriously. And I know that they work really hard to make sure that they make some of the best records in the world.
Yeah.
And that's really a stated goal of theirs. And I really respect that. And, you know, Acoustic Sounds in Salina, Kansas, another place they just got sick of other people pressing their records for them because they were contracting to do Blue Note reissues and, you know, really sexy 180, 200 gram reissues, audiophile pressing. And they would come back with pressing defects. So they ended up buying their own pressing machines and they run their own pressing. And so they were, you know, these are two examples of in two very different entities, but trying to make sure that things are good. Mm-hmm. And my return rate for an event like Record Store Day, it used to be, it's never been that high, but it's almost like zero now.
That's great.
Yeah. So overall, buying new records is a much better experience for the consumer. There's a whole lot of other problems, but quality control isn't one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you a general question about how you got into music and into records, but I think instead we could use as a vehicle for that what your five albums would be if you were stranded in a remote Colorado cabin during a zombie apocalypse with nothing but food, water, and a crank-powered Victrola. I'm
pulling in deep.
Yeah.
I really hate questions like this.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's no shade to no, you know, I get it. But the whole idea of the desert island disc was another phrase that's been used. And it's just like, you got more problems. If you're stuck like this, you got way more problems. It's just kind of, it's just silly. It's like most zombie movies. They're just silly. Yeah. They're a lark.
Yeah. Well, I like to stress that these are your five for today.
And that's another thing. It's like, well, so, and because I'm not trained as a historian and I'm not really an intellectual, but I'm going to answer like a record nerd slash historian, you know.
Yeah, I think this will give us a little window into your history as a music. Well,
and it's geek. It reflects on how I sell records and how I approach it, because one of the things that's happening, and you and I touched on it in that previous profile you did in Westward, was I called it like record store literacy.
Yeah.
And how to be in a record store. What does it mean to be in a record store that isn't I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm going to flash forward because there's something I wanted to bring up if you didn't bring it up. Where stores seem to be headed now is because there's so much new product coming out and so many new bands, and everybody wants to get their stuff pressed to vinyl, because when you tour, it's t-shirts and records. That's how that's what your merch table is populated with.
Koozies.
So there's, and koozies, beer koozies. I don't know anything about those. But anyway, stores are going to be more like they were in the late 80s, early 90s, because they're just going to have so much new product. Mm. And I think a store like, I haven't been in it in several years, but a store like Twist and Shout in Denver has always been that, but probably is only more so now. The ratio of new vinyl to used vinyl is probably like, I don't know, 2 or 3 to 1.
I think they've also always done a good job of just selling stuff.
Well,
tons of music themed stuff.
They've got the whole, you know, Gene Simmons Kiss lunchbox
thing. Yeah, stuff like that. Exactly.
And which has never been my, you know, thing. But you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I think I don't think it, I'm not predicting, but it wouldn't surprise me if one day we opened up the paper and said that Tower Records is reopening in America, going to do one in LA and Chicago and New York, which they've kept one in Tokyo, but you know, that was the demise in the late 90s, early, well, no, it was like, it was 06, 04, 05, 06 when Virgin Mega Music and Tower and what were the other big
Sam Goody.
Retailers just folded up all of a sudden.
I used to go to the Tower and the Virgin Records in San Francisco downtown when CDs had gone up to $18.99 plus tax, and the only way, you know, like it was an investment. So you had to go to the store and like there were those stations. You would stand at the station.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot.
And just listen to all the albums and then think, okay, this is one that I... like I'm gonna pick out of all of these. Yeah, whereas now you just go on the Spotify and listen to the like, brand new record.
Pre-Spotify, pre-whatever, Apple Music. It's pre-Napster even. Yeah. You know, it's just crazy to think what has happened. But anyway, so that's my prediction. Is like so stores are like they were, you know, 30 or so years ago.
Yeah. All right, album number one.
Well, I started thinking, how do I want to approach this? And I'm just going to cut to the bottom line because I know we're pressed for time. There is a jazz composer. I want to think of him as a composer first.
Okay.
Named Herbie Nichols. He's a brilliant piano player, and he's an absolute master. He was friends with Thelonious Monk. Mm-hmm. I put him on up there with Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk. He had a brilliant harmonic imagination, a great melodic sense, and a really wonderful sense of rhythm. And what else? Those are the three legs that any composition stands on. And he was he didn't really flourish, but he was active in the late 50s. He only recorded two full-length records, one for Blue Note Records and then one for an album, for a label called Bethlehem Records, which was a great label, but it was a kind of a minor label. Mm-hmm. A lot of major talent recorded on it. And prior to those two dates, he recorded two 10-inch LPs, the precursor to the 12-inch LP that we're more familiar with, on Blue Note. And he was playing with Max Roach and Art Blakey, two absolute master American, you know, so-called jazz drummers. And Curly Russell on bass, and there was probably another bass player, and his name's escaping me. But if you're a jazz fan and you think that you know something about modern jazz, you know, post World War II, you know,
Herbie Nichols.
Yeah, Herbie Nichols is your guy.
You think this would kind of calm the zombies too? Like they would be into it?
Well, considering his parents, I believe, were from. At least one of them was from Trinidad.
Oh, wow.
So you're kind of down in where the whole, that voodoo, whatever you want to call that, was sort of seeded. And I think that you could definitely animate a voodoo-themed sort of, if somebody was doing some kind of graphic novel or some comic strip, you could definitely use a couple of his tunes as a soundtrack to like a zombie dance type
thing. That's perfect. That's zombie jamboree.
Yeah. Well, that's a totally different flavor. You know, I'm going to Harry Belafonte territory. Yeah.
All right, number two. Everybody loves the sound of a train in the distance.
Yeah, trains are lovely.
Yeah.
And are really important in jazz. Duke Ellington. Not one of my picks, but yeah, he was in Wynton Marsalis. Also, I used to write a lot too, and was writing about this piece about Wynton Marsalis, and the notation of mechanization is the phrase I coined to describe how these guys could hear the sound of a city.
And
you can spiral into that too. It happened in the blues when Muddy Waters went from the fields and the rhythms he used there when it was plow and mule to the city where it's factory and trains and,
got my
and
mojo
trucks
working.
And things like that. Yeah. Mm. And he plugged in. Anyway, so number two, Hard Pivot. I really like classical music.
Really?
Yeah. And I figured this is probably an arena, an area that no one in the previous 55.
There have been a couple of people like Joy Adams, Dr. Joy Adams.
Brilliant cellist. Definitely. Cellist, multi-instrumentalist. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. All right.
But just a few.
I'm standing in good company then.
Yeah.
So And, you know, we just got the film about Leonard Bernstein, which...
Oh, I'd like to see that. Not great?
I didn't like it.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyone out there who likes it, nothing. I mean, we could talk about it. I would love to, but I got opinions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I started thinking about, you know, all the modern composers, the 20th century, this century from hell, you know, where so much happened in terms of conflict, as well as just this artistic, you know, just explosion mm-hmm. at various points in time and different locations. And so I was thinking, who do I want to pick? Well, I thought Gustav Mahler, Olivier Messiaen, Sergei Prokofiev, Benjamin Britten, and then somebody like Erik Satie, who was just kind of like this strange universe unto himself. Each of these artists is sort of a universe unto themselves. And then I came back to Dmitri Shostakovich.
I know nothing about this subject.
One little line that maybe will hook you in interest. Mm-hmm. The man, he's Russian, of course. He was born, I'm just going to check my notes. He was born in 1906, mm-hmm. and he died in 1975. So he saw these minor wars that we don't even know about in our teaching of world history in America, but there was this minor, I think there was a minor war around the period of World War II where America was involved in trying to disrupt part of Russia. Huh. Russia, of course, it had its own internal civil war, which was incredibly brutal and bloody during the same period as the First World War, which was a huge, you know, cataclysm. And then he also got to, you know, the Second World War and then all that and then the Cold War. And so I believe it's true, but I heard it as an anecdote, that Shostakovich, he was an uncompromising artist who believed in Russia and what it meant to be Russian and loved his country and all the richness of its culture. And with the rise of the Soviet system, always lived on this edge of running afoul of what became this very rigid system that regulated aesthetics of any kind.
The Iron Curtain.
And, well, it was to anything to forward the revolution would be like a, you know, a way of putting it. And art doesn't play with that. You know, art's going to challenge boundaries. Art's always, you know, true art is like pursuing what's just beyond the edge of what's known, what's understood.
So that's how you would describe his music, pursuing beyond the edge of what's known.
Yeah, I really would. And the piece I wanted to mention is his last symphony. He wrote 15 symphonies. The guy was very prolific, and each of his symphonies is kind of a universe unto itself. Some of them are really political. Some of them are very... The first and the fifth are very accessible. Mm-hmm. The first, because he was coming out and he was trying to establish himself. So it's very accessible and tuneful and delightful, but it's still like, it's very modern. You know, it's not atonal or anything, but it's like there's some tartness to it. And then the fifth, he'd fallen out of favor. And I'll go back to what I wanted to say. For a lot of his life, he lived with a suitcase packed by the door of where he was living because he had a network of friends that might alert him, they're coming for you.
Right, right.
And he would grab that suitcase and just flee. And I'm sure he had a planned route. And he lived like that because he would get in trouble. And he had friends that were killed in purges.
That's how you're going to have to live if the zombies are at your door, too.
The 15th symphony, it's a really, really personal symphony, but it's also very playful. It's mysterious and playful, and almost like the last bars, literally to the last bars of it, are just this incredible little rhythmic figure that, as a percussionist, you would find really fascinating. And it ends like that, and you're like, I have no idea what that meant.
Well, that sounds amazing.
It just left with this huge question mark. Yeah, and it's so I get goosebumps just thinking about it. It's so good.
We put one song from each album choice on a playlist on Spotify called Mile High Stash, and it goes by year, so we'll put something from that on there.
Okay, well, we can talk about that offline, how we work that out. Yeah. Anyway.
All right, number three.
Okay, Galloping Ahead. I made notes, folks, just because, you know, it's too juicy.
Because of course you did.
Yeah, well, it's who I am. It's why Adam loves me. Yeah. So you know who Wayne Shorter is?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And I was I was hoping you'd say, of course. A jazz saxophonist who's most well known possibly for being a founding member of Weather Report.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing. He was in the Miles Davis, the second great Miles Davis quintet from like 64 to 70, I think it was.
With a very young Tony Williams.
Like a 17-year-old Tony Williams, mm-hmm. Monster Ron Carter, Herbie mm-hmm. Hancock. They were all young.
Yeah.
And Miles was, you know, sort of the elder. By I don't know how many years, not that many years, eight years yeah. or so. And then, of course, with Joseph Zawinul founding yep. Weather Report.
And Bitches Brew.
And he was on Bitches Brew. Yeah. So Wayne Shorter, he had like a 60-plus year career. And he was creative up until, you know, I think he retired from performing in 2018. And for those of you who might not know who he is, he died last year in like March. And there was a great outpouring of love and affection and even sorrow, because he was just this incredibly wonderful human being who was also kind of mysterious, unusual, but really, really creative.
So you're choosing one of his records.
Yeah. And it's from because I can't keep it simple. There's a period in 1969, early 70, where he was departing Miles Davis, but hadn't formed Weather Report yet. Mm. And he did three recording sessions on the Blue Note label, and they're all available under these titles. The first one was from 69, it's called Supernova. The second one was recorded early 1970 and was issued under the title of Moto Grosso Fio. And then later in 1970, a third recording session yielded an album he titled Odyssey of Isca. And what I find interesting about those records is that they don't derive a whole lot from like the Bitches Brew and in a silent way sessions that he did with Miles.
It was more just his style.
Like it's
his
voice. And it's not just his style. He's pivoting towards something new.
Yeah.
And in a way, I'm going to go out suddenly and be bold. It's like, it's this bubble of creativity that he never really revisited. There's elements, there's even songs themselves from those three albums that appeared on early Weather Report records, maybe one or two. But because Joe Zawinul was such a dominating figure and brought all his, you know, first the electric piano and ring modulators and then synthesizers out the wazoo, Wayne's place in the band was always just kind of this, again, just kind of this mysterious thing, because it's one voice of a tenor or soprano sax against a bank of synthesizers.
Yeah.
So that was part of the push-pull of that band that's really interesting. But those three albums, Supernova, Odyssey of Isca, and Moto Grosso Fio, they have a little bit of a Brazilian feel to them at times, and there's no electronics. They're entirely acoustics. There's no electric piano. Synths didn't really exist yet. So, but he'd been hanging out with Zawinul and Keith Jarrett and Chick Corea playing electric pianos with Miles Davis towards the end of his stay there. But he did this all acoustic. And the only chordal instruments are guitars and marimba. And Chick Corea plays marimba on a couple of those sessions. So anyway, and they're very adventurous. Sometimes they get a little bit abstract, but there are chords there, and there's rhythms there. Alfonso Muzan, Aerto Moreira is on them, and they're really incredible albums.
Well, I'm excited for people to hear those. Yeah.
And they're very different than the Art Blakey flavored stuff that he did. He was with Art Blakey for 5 years, and his own solo albums from like 67 back are incredible. He wrote so many great tunes. He's genuinely a giant, you know. He's in the world of American, I'm reluctant to use the word jazz anymore, but it's the go-to expression, because there's so many, you know, black artists who just are sort of pushing back against that. And the pushback has always been there. Charles Mingus, you know, he refused to call it jazz.
Right.
Ellington kind of bristled at the term. You know, it's like black classical music and things like that. Mm. African American classical music. Anyway.
Well, you are a giant in the you know, record and stereo equipment.
I just love this shit, though. So it's just, yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more about you and about the shop, and then we'll come back to your number four, number five albums.
They'll go much. They're a lot simpler. Know. Yeah.
When did you arrive in Colorado?
November 97.
And then you opened the store, of course, that must have been...
It was 08. I signed the lease in 08 and opened, but I officially opened in 09.
And that's the one that was up on like Broadway and Violet?
A building. The police... Not the shack. Police. The fire department came by to inspect that building like every 4 or 5 months.
Yeah.
Because it should have been condemned. I mean, it was just like, there was asbestos, there was loose wires. I never saw anything spark, but I wouldn't have been surprised if it... And the funny thing, interesting thing about that is it was part of a remnant of an entire world that existed in North Boulder where there used to be lots of, let's call it affordable housing. There were trailers, but this town from the 60s on was a home for people who had a hard time dealing with life, so to speak. Mm. And particularly, you know, Vietnam vets and probably Korean War vets going back to the Beats, you know, with Kerouac, mm-hmm. the legend of Kerouac living around here. And a lot of people have found this valley, let's call it, you know, a place where a home for the disaffected and disadvantaged and, you know, disgruntled.
Yeah.
And I was there in a sort of like the last days of that. There's still a tiny thumbprint of it left, but I met some interesting people that had been in Boulder for, you know, decades. Even in back in the early 2000s, had been here for 30, 40 years.
Well, even 15 years ago up in North Boulder, there was nothing. It like there are like housing plans and giant apartment buildings that just weren't there. There was
yeah. Well, it was fine. You know, the 08 was the housing crisis.
Yeah,
and that was part of my insane rationale. If I can make it in the depths of a recession, things will probably be okay.
And how many years was it until you moved out to Arapahoe?
I was only there about 16 months.
Okay. And then you moved out to Arapahoe.
I couldn't wait to get out of there. I proved my model. It was popular. I was in the black from the first month on, and I stepped into a much bigger rent, swallowed hard, got a much shinier, brighter place. Couldn't afford downtown. There wasn't a whole lot available. By then, things were sort of turning around for the economy. But, you know, I was out across from Ball Aerospace out on East Arapahoe, and that was a great spot for 8.5 years. It was great.
Yeah.
That's when you and I... We'd met already by then, I think.
We did an in-store with the Yoppers back in like the fall of 2011, I think.
In East, that's what I remember in East Arapahoe.
Yeah.
I used to a lot of cool shit in that shop.
Yeah.
It was great. Yeah. It's nice to be. And by the way, I'm not dragging it in. I'm welcoming it in with open arms, remembering Andy Schneidkraut.
Well, he's still with us.
He's still with us.
Remembering his story.
Yeah, and then well said. And he will live longer
for
having retired from Albums on the Hill. But he held that down for 35 years.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I adore that man, and I admire him. And he's an irascible teddy bear, you know?
He's one of my favorite people
on
Earth. And his son's a great guy, too.
His son's a brilliant filmmaker and a really good man, and I got to plug the film. Dan, the son, made a film about Dan's relationship with his father, Andy, and their existence is in Boulder. Boulder is as big a character in that film.
Exactly.
It's a really wonderful film. I recommend it highly if you're interested in the history of Boulder.
Boulder used to have more record stores per capita than anywhere in the country.
I've heard that spin on it.
It was just everywhere.
And he told me that I'm sure it didn't last for more than a couple of years, but there were 16 at one point existing simultaneously in a town of what, like 25, 30,000 people.
Yeah. And I hope that if Andy is listening to this, that he comes and fucking sits down with me and records an episode of Mile High Stash, because I know he went through health issues and he's still recovering, but I just I want that to happen really bad.
I will assist you.
Yeah, yeah. So it does seem like you've really found your niche. You've found your home on Main Street in Longmont.
What the hell? Get existential. I don't know if I've ever felt at home anywhere.
Wow.
It's really weird.
Well, I could just do therapy now, too.
I've done lots of inner work. And notions like that come to me quite freely. And it's actually comforting to say, to know myself so well. But I was an only child. My growing up, my father was he was a really smart man, kind of brilliant, but he was a really rough father.
Mm.
And he was really hard on my mom, really hard on her. He was hard on me, but it was more like me witnessing that dysfunction.
Do you have a hard time being proud of yourself, Doug?
I'm always looking for what I can do next. So yes, I think I am restless like that. So
have you read In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts by Dr. Gabor Mate?
During COVID, didn't we all have some spare time?
Yeah, yeah.
So Basil van der Klok and Peter Levine and Kathy Kane and Gabor Mate, nice. those, I don't know how I just, good fortune and desperation, you know, it's like, what the fuck is going on with all of us?
I'm trying to be...
So yes.
I definitely identify with some of the things that you're saying, and Gabor Mate in particular has inspired me to try to slow down and not be, I was addicted to work and
and cycling.
Yeah.
And you're kind of a Viking about that too. You know?
Well, Gabor Mate says that when you're not wanted as a kid, or at least you don't feel that you're wanted, that you often get addicted to work because you find ways to be needed.
And that's his, just in case you're, listeners aren't familiar, he was born right at the beginning of the Second World War
in Hungary,
in Budapest.
Yeah, yeah.
And the period didn't last for very long, and I'm putting the cart before the horse because this is how I structure my drama.
Yeah.
But his mom, he was 2 or 3 years old.
She handed him off to somebody.
She handed him in the street to a stranger because they were Jewish and she was afraid for his life.
Yeah.
And this is an age, we don't have memories from that age, but he knows that he carries that viscerally in his nervous system. It's imprinted that his mom abandoned him.
Yeah.
And that's not the appropriate word to use, but when you're abandoned, that's the only word there is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's getting towards 80 years old by now, I imagine. And he can still feel that in him. Yeah.
So sometimes when we have childhood trauma, which we all have at some different levels,
unavoidable. Yeah.
We never feel like, no matter what we accomplish, no matter what we do, no matter how busy we are, we don't feel valued, and that's why we keep doing that. But the key, which is easier said than done, is to value yourself and be comfortable sitting in a room meditating,
which
something like that
I do a lot of.
That's great.
It's lovely to hear you use your own personal vernacular with the word value, whereas I use the word love.
It's interchangeable. That's good.
It is and it isn't, because everybody's different.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the beauty. What was the beauty? I'm going to tear up right now. Is that when two people can spontaneously, unplanned, have the kind of conversation that you and I are having, which is lovely also, because we see each other once or twice a year maybe, but we've been aware of each other for 15 years. And I see you out in the world on your IG account, and you see me and you hear rumors and whispers about shit that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Likewise. And that's a lovely thing. So thank you, Adam. This is
wonderful. I'm proud of you and I value and love you for sure. I was going to say that, like, I remember your shop being full on, like, record store day. And there have been times, and I know how you feel about record store day, but...
mixed.
Yeah, but ever since you moved to Longmont, there have been times when I stopped by and it felt like, oh, this whole place is packed like it was record store day. And I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's doing so well.
Yeah. people like what I do. I'm shaking my head, you know, and it's like, you're right. I just, you know, it's hard to give yourself a break if you're put together a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
do you feel like a Coloradoan? Like you feel like this is your place now?
You know, when I mentioned South Carolina, mm-hmm. if this is a weird thing to say, but if my life totally got upended, I don't even want to be particular about it, and I had freedom, mm-hmm. I would probably do something really crazy, like move back to where my grandfather, mm-hmm. my father's father, was a farmer.
Yeah.
Not buy rent, put my shit in storage here,
yeah.
but just go back and just see, you know, try and revisit that. I think it's a, you know, it's, I turned 64, and I don't consider myself old. I'm in really good health, but...
You look great.
But I have a good friend of mine's partner died last week.
Oh, no.
She was only 44, 45. One of my best friends... I'm just going to start tearing up. Why not?
Thanks for sharing.
He's somebody I was in high school with, mm-hmm. and he's going into hospice.
Wow.
And we rediscovered each other in the past few years, yeah. and it's been lovely, and it's going to go away.
I'm sorry to hear that, man.
And he was a great man. He, to tell the story about him, he wrote for The Simpsons for a little while. He tried stand-up for a little while. Again, he would be a nice trio. He would join us with these people who, you know, these people who work really hard, very talented,
yeah.
good at what they do, have lots of friends, people that really regard them highly even, but is hard on himself.
What's his name?
Reed Harrison.
Reed Harrison.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that. And he's friends with Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah.
They were buddies in L.A. before... He was with Bob Odenkirk when Vince Gilligan called Bob Odenkirk to pitch him
Breaking Bad.
For joining Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. And when Bob hung up the phone, he turned to Reed and said, "Who's Vince Gilligan?" And Reed responded, "Call him back right now."
Yeah.
"Call him back right now." And he did. And when Reed told me that, I mean, just like you're in silence, because Breaking Bad's one of the greatest TV shows ever. Saul Goodman is one of the greatest characters in American television literature.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was Reed's, that was part of the world Reed was in.
So you went to high school together in
Yeah, and that North was a Carolina. Trip too. No, I went to a fancy boarding school.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why it's kind of special. It was... I did not fit. Talk about, well, there was a lot of people that didn't fit in at that school, but it was a fancy. Our president, George Bush's youngest brother, was two classes ahead of me. That's how fancy it was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's surprising. You don't strike me as a fancy boarding school guy.
Well, that's why we talk about it. I wanted to write a book about my high school experience. And it'll never happen. Yeah. Another book I want to write about, which will never happen at this point anyway, but it dawned on me, the history of the cocaine trade through Boulder County.
Yeah.
I think you would probably, you'd end up being found in a river.
I have some friends who
face
can probably
face
help
down
you.
If you try to write that book.
I have some friends who can probably help you with the research on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, that goes back to hanging out in North Boulder and all those old timers who've been around. Yeah.
Anyway. So you still feel like
this makes me feel at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean,
yeah.
I have thought about moving a lot over the years, and I've come to a place where wherever my partner, Michaela, is, and wherever my daughter is, I mean, those are the places I want to be. And as much as there are things I don't like about Boulder County and Colorado that don't feel like me, also, no matter where I went, I would realize that, like, my 16 years here in the community that I've built, I miss it a lot.
Your vitae is impressive, you know. You've done a lot.
I don't know if I've done a lot, but I've made a lot of friends, and I would miss them.
That's part of what you've done.
The thing that frustrates my kid the most about how no matter where we go, I run into, I think I, did I see you at the Velveteer show at the Fox when we were there?
No.
But no. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, we're
the same happens
like,
to me.
At yeah. the bar and then upstairs yeah. and then downstairs. And she's like, it takes a half hour just to get through this room because you know everybody. And I'm yeah. like, yeah, I would miss that. I would definitely miss that.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's why, you know, moving to South Carolina, I would be totally naked, you know. Yeah.
Well, there's nothing like the place where you found yourself and you found your niche and all of that, but there's nothing like where you're from. I mean, when I'm in Pittsburgh, I feel like the streets are just like no different than my limbs. There's just a part
that's
of
a, yeah.
where I'm from.
And me, something about the dirt. I mean, you yeah. know, my grandfather's I'm no more a farmer than I'm an astronaut, you know, or a brain surgeon or something. But there was something about that man. And that literally, it's this cliche thing, the way he smelled.
Yeah.
You know, the way he shuffled when he walked, the way he talked. It's just, to me, it's like this fascinating other world.
How often do you go home?
I don't.
Not at all?
There's no one. There's
just because you don't know anybody.
Yeah. And my cousins, I'm in communication, but we're not in... It's not a strong, the friendship element of relationship with relatives is not strong. The sense of kinship is probably stronger than we understand in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you feel about, you know, what you've accomplished in 15 years here?
Well, that's, you caused me to think about it. The invitation... The generous invitation to be on your podcast, which I'm honored to be in, because you're building quite a catalog of interesting conversations. You know, I highly recommend dipping into it, folks.
Thank you.
You know, I'm just looking for what I can do next. So I don't know. I don't know how if this is an act of life and you know a chapter. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it's going to end because I'm such a hard head.
Yeah.
And I can't stay out of trouble. You know, I just keep wanting to. Figure out something else to do. I want to host live music in Longmont as I did in Boulder, but finding a venue is hard. There's not many good rooms, and I want to present things that are very against the grain of the, you know, Americana, whatever you call it, the banjo inflicted or inflected
yeah
stuff. Yeah.
I want to hear you say something nice about yourself and about the shop and what you've accomplished, because like 15 years, just the fact that you've survived, that the shop has survived is amazing. And there are other people who start record stores or buy a surviving record store as a hobby after they've already had their success yeah. in life. And you and Andy are lifers. It's a totally different thing. The fact, fact that you survived is amazing.
And you got to throw Bart Stinchcomb's name in there
yeah.
too. You
yeah.
know, just to, you know, respect and honor. He had Bart's. For 30 or 35
yeah.
years. That was why I wanted to do something as a tribute to Andy, and I wanted to involve the Fox and artists that he's known since before, like Nathaniel and Gregory Allen Isakoff. And I just couldn't get the traction. And there's a story there, but let's not do that
yeah.
now. And that really bugged me. So that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I just keep putting my shoulder to the wheel and kind of going against the grain quietly. So I don't know. That's that in itself. I'm stubborn.
Yeah.
I love myself because I'm so freaking stubborn.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
it's about holding a space. That's a cliche too, but holding a space, holding a vision. And, you know, you and those knuckleheads and the yoppers walk through my door one day. And I'm still friends with all three of you.
Yeah.
And I love you all, you know, and that's been a huge gift. So there's another way of loving myself is just saying, thank you, life, for having these people come through that door. Without that door, I would not know you. Opening the shop opened my life up to these great experiences.
Yeah, but let's go back. Just, I mean, you...
Are all these conversations get so philosophical? Yeah. And...
No, not all of them.
Yeah.
Just quickly, though, I mean, you and Annie are partners and crying.
You're She's the reason I came out here. She's the reason I came out. She didn't drag me out here. We had jobs that could were portable. It was before I even imagined I would open a record store. I just thought, what a bunch of fools. I would never open a record store.
Yeah.
You know, I'll do shows. I'll do mail order. I'll get on eBay. But opening a store, this is like the equivalent of putting a gun in your mouth. it's just like suicide.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of what Andy Schneidkraut's son, Dan, you know, said in the movie Old Man, where he was like, the fact that Andy was able to succeed and stay in business all those years was a man who was buried underneath his dream. His dream coming true was the worst nightmare.
Dan Schneidkraut is a really perceptive man. Andy was too, but I think Dan... we've never talked about your dad, but when I talk about my dad, there is a tremendous witness value there, seeing myself as a reaction against and an embodiment of at the same time sometimes, which is really confusing.
Yeah.
Things that you find repellent and you embody in yourself.
Yeah.
I forswore any kind of violence. I've still got anger and impatience, but my dad was just... he was violent. And he grew up on a farm. Farms are inherently violent places. His father had a temper. And I imagine my great grandfather, whom I know nothing about, probably had, is Scotch Irish.
Yeah.
You know? So he's impervious to the psychotherapy crowd, you know?
Right.
Hell ridden human beings. And my dad was in that World War II generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I knew some of his friends. One of them was, you know, he was at Normandy, and I was hearing these stories. They would tell me, I was, you know, I don't know why they would open up. The profile generally is veterans don't talk about their experiences, but a couple of times these men opened up to me, and it was like they could tell that I was somehow receptive, and they gave me just enough, and it stuck with me. A B-17 pilot,
yeah,
you know? And that was my dad's generation, and so I kind of have to cut him a wide berth. Who knows what kind of Gabor Mate? You come back to that. What kind of experiences he had that, you know, cemented this thing in him that could only be expressed isn't the right way, but find a way to express itself out of him was just by being violent. Yeah.
There's this other book. You know,
it's a horrible thing to think, but it's true. I mean, human beings are kind of, we're pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
You know, we do some fucked up stuff.
Well, there's this other book called The Body Keeps the Score. Do you know this book?
Yeah.
And one of the great things I took from that book was, instead of asking, what the fuck is wrong with you? We say, what happened to you?
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of that. Maybe it would be a form of psychotherapy, you know, to give me your number 4 and 5.
Well, this is the joyous part. Identifying with the story of some of these musicians, especially somebody like Herbie Nichols, you know, he got tuberculosis and he was gone at like 45 years of age, you know, and died in probably broke and obscure, you know, kind of obscurity. These recordings, I highly recommend them. They're so good. And it's just fun music. So, but anyway, this is a hard pivot. I sat down and went through like two other versions of my 5 records to choose because I kept having these sort of different theses, you know, these ways of entering the whole process and inquiry. And this is sort of a representative of an entire 5 LP thing. There's a British band called Jade Warrior.
Oh, I don't know them.
And the reason I chose them is because so many records have just gotten so expensive. And kind of whether it's soul or funk or jazz or rock or folk or not so much classical anymore, but just across the board. And this could be a whole show in itself if you wanted to do Nerds on Vinyl edition of... the stash. But Jade Warrior came out of a band called July, a British band, a psych band. They put out one album in 1968, an original pressing of that record. It was a legendary record 20, 30 years ago easily, but it was traded at hundreds of dollars. Mm-hmm. Now, if you can find a copy, Because again, it's a country the size of North Carolina, an obscure band, no hits, no possibility, no commercial appeal, at least on radio, especially with the BBC. So they probably made 5,000 copies of it, maybe 10. But that record goes for $2,000 to $4,000.
Wow.
And it's if you can find one, well, I don't know if it's that good. That's another issue. There are records
it's just that
was
rare.
That was part of that thesis, because there, especially in the world of jazz, which I know really well, there is some kind of so-so records that go for a lot of money, and artists that have records that command that if it's on the right label, but they have records on different labels that are just as interesting that go for a fraction of these really these grail records. So anyway,
we'll make sure to put the a Jade Warrior song on.
There's some good ones. They're an interesting band. So Jade Warrior came, their first record was in 1970. It's very guitar dense. They would use multi-tracking. The guitar player's really, he was into tone and timbre and worked really hard on his guitar tones. So think like Brian May, who's somebody who really sculpted his guitar parts. Is like orchestral almost,
and used a penny as his pick to get that sound.
All kinds of tricks. But anyway, so their first record, just for context, if you find a UK pressing, it's on this sought-after label called Vertigo Records. Is a $200-$300 record. But if you find an American pressing of that same record, it's a $30-$40 record. So in the parlance of the Instagram, you know, it's cheap heat, baby. Which just, I hate that expression.
All right, your fifth and final. Zombie.
And the fifth, the fifth one. This was another tact I took, is pursuing just musicians, and I started thinking of like, who are some great pocket bass players that you would think of as being more like soul and funk bass players who landed in the world of rock?
Larry Graham.
He's Graham Central Station and Sly Stone. Where do you put Sly Stone? I put it in the rock, but is it funk? Is it soul? Is it, you know, he's
all
got
of the above.
That's the brilliance of Sly.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's three bass players. I'm just going to name check. There's a guy named Lonnie Turner. If you're into bass players, very funky, but his most famous The most well-known record that he appeared on was a record from about 74 that Dave Mason put out. You know, a great rock player, but not really a terribly funky. But Lonnie Turner, that thing about the groove and the pocket, you know, the drummers rule the band.
Well, your band's only as good as your drummer. Even if you don't rule the band, I'm going to dictate whether it's...
I'll stick with it. Well, you know. Yeah, it's true. It's a subtle... You know, regality. It's actually not so subtle. Can you imagine Led Zeppelin with any other drummer? No. John Bonham was just so fucking good.
Can you imagine John Bonham in any other band?
That's an even harder because I don't even know where I would go with that. Anyway, so and then there's another guy named Gerald Johnson.
I love that you turned your list question into there's a meta list.
I'm going to have my own way with the situation. It's just who I am. And Gerald Johnson, he's on the Steve Miller Band record called The Joker.
Yeah.
And there's some brilliant bass playing on that record. And he's just so, he's funky. And then the last one is a guy named Willie Weeks, who probably hung out in Boulder at some point, because he was associated with Joe Walsh at one point.
Oh, yeah.
And I just think, you know, all these guys could have been in Boulder. It's everybody came to Boulder at one point. Boulder's just this place where musicians came. Even before Caribou got established. And so the record, I'm going to pivot hard again because I haven't talked about soul music, but Willie Weeks is on a Donnie Hathaway album that is just one of the greatest live albums, period, and it's simply called Donnie Hathaway Live.
And I think Mark Towns from Kind Hearted Strangers shows that record on My High Stash.
Donnie
too.
Hathaway,
he
died young, and he's one of these, there's another meta list, is like he's mysterious deaths. He ended up out a window four or five stories up, down onto the pavement, dead. At, you know, he's probably, I can't, he may not have even made 30 or early 30s.
Wow.
huge hits with Roberta Flack, in his own right, his solo records, they're up there with anything Curtis Mayfield did. I mean, he's just really, really brilliant. And so my little meta list there was like The Mysterious Death of Elliot Smith.
Nick Drake
was on it.
Jeff Buckley.
Jeff Buckley would be, I didn't have him down, but even Brian Jones.
Yeah.
And then this brilliant jazz guitarist, Canadian jazz guitarist who could play in any idiom, Lenny Bro, dear friend of Chet Atkins. Huh. They all just had these mysterious deaths.
That's a whole other show.
That is a whole other show. Yeah. That's what I bring.
Yeah, yeah. So, I wanted to, okay, we're officially over our hour, so
you knew it was gonna happen.
Thank you for coming by, and I want to ask you a ridiculously dorky question, you know, because one of my favorite things that I like to do with my rock albums from the 60s and 70s especially is to take the record and look at it under a light and see if there's anything special written in the runout, you know, other than the code that says where it was printed and stuff. And, you know, Patti Smith is a person who, like, was a music geek and then, you know, became a rock star. And so she knew about that kind of thing. And she would do little, like, poetic phrases that are scratched into the runout. And then my favorite is Devo, you know, the original Devo record. It's scratched into the runout, says...
We are not men.
Are we not men? The other side says we are Devo. But do you have an example of that you discovered?
Oh, I'm going to run out the length of the show just because I'm thinking. I don't. And there was a period where I studied that stuff because there's real information there about to where things were pressed.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
who the mastering engineer was and what stampers were used. And all those things. And folks, and if you don't know what the runout grooves, it's at the end of the record, the last song, there's this wax where the stylus just rides.
Dead wax is another word for it.
Yeah, it's like dead end. It's dead wax. Yeah. And that's a place where you take a record out and look at it, and you'll see all this coded, these serial numbers and all these little runes, these little symbols and signs that they all mean something.
Yeah.
And it's interesting what you say about Patti Smith and Devo. I will say this, because at that point, by the time the record has been mastered and the test pressings have been created and all that, they've got to create stampers to mass produce records. And it's at that point probably that these little messages get written. Yeah. I can't imagine. I've never seen an acetate that had anything or a test pressing that had anything like that.
Right,
but
right.
I've never thought about this question. This is a whole show right here. I'm not qualified. You need some deeper authorities on this thing. But it's like, who the hell is writing this stuff?
Right.
And how do they get away with it? It was a different, kind of a different time.
I got to have somebody like that on the show and ask him about all that stuff.
Well, again, we'll someday. Talk. I've got some thoughts. You know. I've got some recommendations.
This was really, it's funny because it was during lockdown that I got that bored and nerdy that I was looking at all of my vintage vinyl under lights and realizing sometimes there's something written there that's not the code. It's a little poetic thing or whatever.
There's all kinds of... You know? And, records where somebody like do something like draw a flower or something. I don't know. Art happens in strange ways and in unexpected places. It's like it's a form of graffiti, possibly.
Yeah, exactly.
How you define graffiti?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, thanks so much for coming by, and that's a subject that we can nerd out on another time.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Give you another hour, then I gotta run, I gotta fly away.
That was Doug Gaddy of Absolute Vinyl Records and Stereo, which is right on Main Street on the best stretch of downtown Longmont, Colorado. Make sure to stop by and say hello to Doug and Annie and Giselle sometime and buy some records. Thanks to Doug for stopping by Mile High Stash and to the Roots Music Project for sponsoring this episode. If you can, please give Mile High Stash a review on Apple Podcasts and post about us on your social media stuff. It does go a long way. All right, we'll talk soon next month.